Before we get started, we want to thank Purple and Best Fiends for sponsoring PD Stories. Get a free purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress when you text PD to 84888 and download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm Tom Morris Jr., your host. And today on PD Stories, we're interviewing Professor John Violante.
All of a sudden, I'm driving and I come over this hill and there's a car parked perpendicular across two lanes with all of her lights off.
John Violante is an internationally known expert on police stress. He's a researcher and a police veteran who served as a New York State police trooper for 23 years.
But when you get out there and you see the dead bodies, it takes a toll on your psyche. And if you're not careful, you can develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
Currently, John is a research professor of epidemiology and environmental health at University at Buffalo School of Public Health and Health Professions.
We need to do something about this. We need to establish some programs to help officers get through this stuff because nobody is helping them.
John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
What made you want to become a police officer?
Well, I think it probably all started when I was a young lad, maybe the fourth grade. I remember the school that I went to had this program where they would make you a crossing guard marshal, and they would give you this great-looking white belt that you would put on, and you would help the kids cross the street during recess times. And when I did that, I enjoyed the fact that I was helping people be safer, and it kind of put me on a pathway of doing something like that.
Now, you joined the military at 19, and I understand you told the recruiter that you wanted to be a police officer in the military, correct?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I signed up for the United States Army. I put in 3 years as a military police officer. It was during the Vietnam War. I had not gone to Vietnam. Actually, they had sent me to West Point for military police duty at West Point. And while I was there, you know, even though we were not involved directly in that war, we felt the war. We felt Vietnam. And the reason I say that is that part of our duties at West Point was to conduct military funerals. And maybe two and three times a week, we saw these young second lieutenants coming back, and we had to bury them, and we saw what it did to their family. And it was a tragic time, and I've really never forgotten those times and how that affected me and the other MPs that worked at West Point. Mm-hmm.
So you came out of the military in 1965 and then decided to become a New York State trooper.
Yes, I just went from being a military officer to being a recruit, if you want to call it that, in the State Police Academy training.
A lot of people don't understand that the State Police are sort of a paramilitary style police force, much like the military. What attracted you to becoming a state trooper as opposed to another type of municipal police officer?
The training that I'd heard about is exemplary. And, you know, it's 6 months long, and it's rigorous. And you're right, it's built on military structure. Sometimes we'd go for a little 3-mile run at about 4 o'clock in the morning, which was always fun, but part of the training. They taught us how to deal with stress and how to do things quickly and be good officers.
So you spent most of your career on the New York State Thruway Detail, working the night shift, right?
Worked midnight shifts for almost 8 years.
That's tough.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, it was tough. But actually, I liked it. I mean, that sounds weird, I know, but had a partner. You know, I had somebody to talk to. We did a lot of good work. You know, we did a lot of work with DW, driving while intoxicated, you know, which was a very dangerous type of violation. We did, and it was good. We almost have your own little sort of community out there on night shift. You see the same people. You see the same toll collectors. You stop in the rest area, and you know the same cooks and waitresses are there. I recall once we stopped. It was my partner's birthday, and we stopped at this rest area out near Rochester, and I told the cook, I said, it's my partner's birthday. So she whips up a quick cake, and she gives him the cake. And, you know, that's the kind of camaraderie we had on a throughway in the middle of the night. And that was enjoyable. And, you know, there were a lot of things that happened that were tragic. But having that community really helped us get through that.
Now, what was it like patrolling the New York State Thruway at night, driving 350 miles? I mean, that's a mind-blowing amount of driving. That's like driving from, what, D.C. to, I don't know, Albany or something? I mean, that's a long ways, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is. In the course of a week, we drove from Buffalo to Florida.
Wow.
Let me put it that way. We had a signpost, and our posts were probably 20 to 30 miles long. And if a trooper had to go off for some reason, maybe on an arrest, we had to cover that trooper's post. So I had a post once that went from Buffalo all the way to east of Rochester. And I was supposed to cover that post every hour.
Every hour?
Yeah.
What distance is that?
That's just about 80 miles.
Okay.
So I had to cover that every hour, and I couldn't do that. And, and you know, supervision realized that you can't possibly do that every hour. So when when the sergeant got onto the radio, he said, listen, we understand what's going on. The trooper is involved with an arrest. You're going to have to cover this. Don't worry about the hour. You know, just make sure you cover your post. And we did. Once in a while, the posts were just impossible to cover, and we couldn't do it. We made a lot of arrests out there, especially drugs. The thruway is an interstate road, and a lot of times drugs move through. And we were cognizant of the fact that this was happening.
You had some additional eyes and ears out there too. The toll booth operators, right?
Yes, great people. Great people.
They would tip you off to suspicious vehicles, suspicious people, bad license plates. What kind of stuff?
They would tip us off to mostly driving while intoxicated, drivers that were intoxicated. You know, we'd get a call from, we were all on the same radio system, and we would get a call from a toll booth operator, and she would say, there's a yellow car with license plates, such and such, just came my booth going westbound. He looks really drunk. And they'd get on the air and they would say this. And we would say, if we were as close as we could be, we'd turn around and try to find this individual and check him out. And most of the time, they were good. They were correct. This person was intoxicated, and they were DWIs. And we had to take them in and arrest them. Other things happened out there which were tragic. We had some bad accidents out there at that high speed area, and in the winter time things were tough.
I'll bet in upstate New York.
Yeah, this is still stuck in my memory. That it was Christmas Eve, and we were we were about 20 miles east of Buffalo on the thruway. And we get this call, and it's snowing like crazy. I mean, it's like can't even see the hood of my car. And all of a sudden, we get this call on the radio, and we said, "There's an accident at milepost such and such, and we want you to get down there right away." What happened? Well, it looks like a car hit a tree in the center mall. So we drive as fast as we can. You know, we can't see anything. We're driving down the thruway. We get to the scene of the accident, and it's in a big snowbank in the median. And we get out and we run out of the car, my partner and I. We go in there, and we see what's going on. The other police cars are coming. Other trooper cars are coming. Two others arrive while we're still looking in there. And the car was crunched up right against a tree. It looked like the driver fell asleep, basically. That's what we mm-hmm. thought. The driver was lunged forward through the windshield. His wife in the front seat was lunged through the windshield. They were both dead. And, it hit us because...
This is Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, yeah, it hit us. Oh, my God, it's Christmas Eve. Look at this. So sad, they were probably on their way home for Christmas mm-hmm. and driving home. Mm-hmm. So we called the coroner or the medical examiner. We called the ambulances and all that to take care of this. And then we called the tow truck to winch this car out of there. Well, as we're doing that, before the tow truck gets there, we hear this noise. And I turned to my partner and said, "What is that? It sounds like a cat." And he says, "I don't know." He says, "We better take another look and see what's going on here." So we go back to the car before the truck gets there, and we're looking in the car. We're looking all around the car. Maybe somebody was thrown out. We don't know. We didn't find anything. Finally, my partner looks in the back seat, and he sees a blanket on the floor of the back seat. It's kind of crushed back there because of the impact. Mm-hmm. And he picks up the blanket, and there's a little baby underneath the blanket. Mm-mm-mm. And the baby was alive. And,
wow.
And the baby was crying. And we said, to us, this was a reprieve. I said, "Oh, my God." The kid made it. And we took him out of the car. We wrapped him in our – we had these blankets in our trunks, and we wrapped him in the blanket. Put him in a troop car to keep him warm. The ambulances got there, and we turned the baby to the ambulance. I never forgot that event. I was happy to get home that morning to my own kids and mm-hmm. my own family.
I'm sure.
And enjoy Christmas. But those are the kind of things that happened out there.
So I'm going to tell you about the importance of sleep once again, because it is that important. If I don't get my beauty sleep, I can't do my job. Getting good quality sleep is part of that, so having the right mattress for you is key. If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you need to try Purple, the world's most scientific mattress. It was developed by an actual rocket scientist, and it feels like you're sleeping in zero gravity. Right now, get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress when you text PD to 84888. You'll love Purple. It uses breathable material so you can sleep cool, too. The mattress is both firm and soft to provide support and comfort. Right now, PD Stories listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Again, just text PD to 84888. The only way to get this free pillow is to text PD to 84888. That's PD to 84888. Message and data rates may apply. Are you a fan of true crime? Then you've got to check out the Court Junkie podcast. Imagine being wrongfully convicted for a crime you didn't do, or imagine your child's killer is still on the loose, even though there's enough evidence for an arrest. The Court Junkie podcast shines a light on the injustices of our judicial system by delving into court documents, attending trials, and interviewing those closest to these cases. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every week. I understand there was another incident where a woman parked her car perpendicular to traffic for some reason. Tell me about that.
Yeah, very, very, very scary incident for us. My partner and I, we were tooling along again, probably around Rochester somewhere, and about 3:30 in the morning. All of a sudden, I come over this hill. I'm driving, and I come over this hill. And there's a car parked perpendicular across two lanes with all of her lights off. So, and I was going, I was doing 65, 70 miles an hour, and I'm coming over this hill. And, wow, all of a sudden she's there. So I slam on the brakes, and we did stop. And I said, "What the heck is going on here?" We pull over to the side, we turn on our lights. I walk up to the car, and there's this woman sitting behind the wheel of the car crying. And I said, "What are you doing?" She says, I don't want to live anymore. Mm. I want to die. And she was a little bit intoxicated as well. And she wanted to, basically, she wanted to die by suicide. Mm-hmm. So finally, we had to take her out of the car and get that car off the road. And we did that, put her in our police car, and we had to take her in for sobriety testing and breathalyzer and so forth. A very dangerous situation like that happens. And we got that sort of thing. We'd get people. We had a woman once who stopped her car in the middle of the driving lane, got out of the car, and started walking down the road.
On the throughway?
On the throughway, yeah. My partner and I had a lot of trouble trying to, number one, stop her and try to get her off the road, but she was resisting us. And traffic is flowing by, and here we are in the middle of the road, wrestling with this woman, trying to get her off the road.
That's crazy.
I know. Another time, we're driving down the throughway, and a car's coming the wrong way down the throughway. Mm. At us, you know. So, of course, we had to dodge that, and we had to somehow turn around and chase that car. And the way we did it is to get on the shoulder of the road with our red lights and so forth to chase that car down. And those were usually DWIs as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of harrowing experiences to enlighten your evening.
There was another incident in Buffalo with a woman and a young girl on a corner.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember that. That was the midnight shift. We went off the thruway to look for a place to eat. It was about, I'd say, maybe 3, 4 in the morning. And we saw this young woman standing on a corner in the city. We were in the city of Buffalo, and she had a young child with her. And I said to my partner, what's she doing here at this time of night with a little kid? He said, I don't know, let's go see. And so we did, and we talked to her, and I said, what's going on? She says, well, I left my home, and I left my husband because, you know, he was abusing me, and we're here, and we have no place to go. I said, well, how did you get here? He said, well, we got on a bus, and we're from Pennsylvania. We got in a bus and we came here. I didn't know where else to go. Why'd you come to Buffalo? I don't know. I just wanted to get away. So I said, well, you can't stay out here all night. You know, it's starting to get cold. She said, well, I have no money. I don't know what to do. I said, all right, then let's go. Come on, get in the car, warm you up a little bit. So we took her, what I did is I took her to this hotel in the city, and it was a reasonable place, you know, a small hotel. And I went up to the guy at the desk and said, listen, you know, you have a room? I have this woman here that really needs this room. And I said, yeah, I have a room available. I said, I'll take care of it, you know, give her the room. So we took her, my partner took her up to the room, and her young child, and he said, listen here, you can stay here tonight, all right? And what I would advise you to do is get in touch with someone from Traveler's Aid or get in touch with someone who can help you, you know, with your domestic violence problem.
Mm. Women's shelter or something like that.
Yeah, and I happened to have some phone numbers I gave her. So she said, and I gave her $10. That's all I had in my wallet at the time. I said, here, you know, when you get up in the morning, you don't have to check out till noon, but when you get up in the morning, go get something to breakfast for you and your young child. And she said, thank you, officer. I really appreciate that. And, these are the kind of things that officers do that people never see, and that officers never talk about, that because, you know, they don't think they need to. They do it because they want to, and that's the nature of being a cop. You know, you're not just there to fight crime; you're there to help people.
That's one of the things that we're most proud of on Live PD, is that a lot of times you get to see officers doing things for people out of the kindness of their hearts, out of their humanity and their compassion. It's not just the punitive policing, but it's the human assistance that they offer. So that's one of the things that we really love to see on Live PD, and we like for the public to be able to see that.
Exactly.
Now, being on Highway Patrol, you must have seen a lot of drugs like we see on Live PD all the time. What are some of the best or worst excuses you had to you got from people about the drugs that they may or may not have had?
Well, you know, you get, you know, people make up various excuses like, oh, I didn't know that was in my pocket. That doesn't belong to me. But you're the only one in the car. Well, I don't know who put it in my pocket. I think it was my girlfriend.
Yeah, gremlins.
I stopped this one car once. There was two young lads in there, and they were speeding. So I pull them over. The driver opens the window, and poof, this puff of smoke comes out. And marijuana. I mean, you know, we're trained. We were trained by the Department of Drugs, or I forget what they called it back then, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous
Drugs. Bureau of Narcotics, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We were trained in the smell of marijuana, and there's no other smell like it. It's very distinct. And this puff of smoke comes out, and I knew it was marijuana because I knew. And I said, well, I smell marijuana. You're going to have to get out of your car. So they did, and then we found maybe a pound of marijuana in the car and had to place them under arrest. But silly things like that. And we've had people driving under the influence of drugs. We'd had experiences on the thruway with truck drivers, for example, who...
The long-haul truckers?
Yes, long-haul truckers. The truckers, a lot of times, who had loads of produce, who came from Florida, for example, and had to get that stuff up here before it's boiled. Mm-hmm. And they drive all day and all night. And what they would do is eventually take amphetamines to make the long haul. And, you know, we've stopped truckers who were a little bit dizzy from taking amphetamines and were spacey, basically.
And sleep deprived.
Yeah. Yes. And driving under the influence of these things was very dangerous. The problem with that, we had to give them essentially a urine test to detect the amphetamines, which took a lot of our time up, but that's what we did back then. Things have gotten better in terms of testing. So we did that. I recall this one incident. One of the troopers at the next station down stopped the trucker to check logbook. And truck drivers are required to carry logs. They can only work so many hours a night, 10 hours a night, and they have to be off. And if you don't keep a logbook, it's a violation of the law. So the trooper was checking the fellow's logbook. The driver looks at him, looks at the road, presses on the gas, and takes off. And the trooper is hanging on the window of the truck. So this trucker is going down the road towards the toll booth with this trooper hanging on the truck. And he's doing, you know, 60 miles an hour. And finally, there were other police cars in the area, and they got this guy pulled over. And, of course, he got arrested for reckless endangerment and under the influence of amphetamines as well. So those are the kind of things that happened out there. Again, you know, sometimes they make the shift interesting.
Was the trooper hurt, or was he okay?
He was okay, yeah, but he was hanging out for dear life, he said.
Wow.
Because if he would have fell off, certainly he would have been really injured badly. Yeah.
Now, there was an incident where a teacher hadn't shown up to school for several days, and you guys did a wellness check. Tell me about that incident.
Oh, yes, I remember that well. I think I was in Buffalo for some reason and stopped at a station. And while I was at this station, a call came into the desk saying there's a report of this teacher, this woman, who hadn't been to work for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want to find out if we can investigate that. So there was a trooper on patrol. I went out with him to look at this. You know, I just happened to be there. And so we walk into this house and knock on the door. Walk in, nobody around. Hello, hello, nobody around. Finally, we walk into the bedroom. And when we get into the bedroom, we see this woman lying in a bed in a pool of blood. And what she had done, essentially, is she had cut both of her wrists. And she was bleeding to death very slowly.
Was she conscious or unconscious?
She was conscious. And we walked up to her, and I walked up to her, and I said, listen, we're going to get you help. I said, and I tried to talk to her about this. I'd done some, had some counseling experience by that point, and I tried to ask her, you know, what's going on in your life that you decided you wanted to do this and so forth. And we talked for about 10 minutes before the ambulance got there.
And you treated her wounds too, I presume?
We sure did. Yeah, we put direct pressure on both wounds as best we could. And finally the ambulance came and took her away. But that I remember that incident, you know, and it happened a long time ago. But it made me understand a little bit how people can get to a point where they don't want to live anymore. Apparently she had been involved in a divorce and had trouble at work and just didn't want to deal with life anymore.
It all became too much.
It did. It came too much for her to handle. But we were glad, and we saved her life, basically. And I was unable to follow up on what happened to her after that, and I assume she had been subject to some counseling and some psychotherapy.
Now, during your rookie year, the Miranda rights came into existence. What was it like working in law enforcement during that time? This was a whole new era in law enforcement, the Miranda rights.
It was. And I was just a young rookie trooper and didn't really understand what was going on. And I got out in the field and I'm hearing all of these older troopers saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're not ever going to get a conviction because we have to, you know, give these people these rights and there has to be a lawyer present and we can't question anybody. We can't get information. And I said, well, you know, yeah, I understand, but, you know, I'm out of college. I'm a little bit liberal at that point. And I said, well, understand this. I mean, if your brother, or your sister, or your wife got arrested for something, wouldn't you want them to have the best benefit of the criminal justice system? You know, wouldn't you want them to have some sort of rights? And, you know, you're right, I guess, you know, that kind of stuff. And,
begrudgingly, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But it smoothed it out after a while. And I think after a couple of years, most of the officers accepted this and understood the reason for it. And, you know, and now it's just common. Everybody knows that you are supposed to get your Miranda's rights. It really, as far as I know, I don't think it really affected much of police work. You know, because officers were still able to interview people, and
a lot of people still voluntarily offered information after being read their Miranda rights. Correct.
Yes, that happened a lot too, and even many of them didn't want a lawyer. They didn't want anything. They just, you know, I'm willing to talk to you. Of course, we'd have them sign that document that they were willing to talk to us, and they would talk. And again, during interviews, we'd ask them again, "You sure you don't want an attorney here? You know, it's your right and so forth." No, I don't want an attorney. I'm willing to talk to you and. You know, cases were solved much like they were before. So I think the impact was good in the sense that, you know, people were getting the rights they were entitled to, and it was good for police. It made them more professional. It made them more likely to get a conviction than if they got illegal evidence in the first place. You know, the old fruits of the poison tree type thing, where you would get a confession which is illegally obtained that can't be used in court. So this helped officers get good legal convictions and to do their job better, basically.
Was there any one particular incident during the early rollout of Miranda rights that you recall that was problematic?
Not really. I think the only case I recall most in my younger years was a rape case where the individual, the complainant wasn't sure that it was a rape. She was undecided as to whether, she was consented or not. And the individual was arrested. The person, she said, well, I think he raped me. But we did arrest him because we had to look at this. And we read the Miranda. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about our investigators. They read the rights to the individual, and she was willing to talk to us. They read the rights to the defendant. He was willing to talk, but he said, I didn't, I'd like an attorney because I didn't do this. You know, it was consensual. So there was a big to-do about that, the fact that he made that statement before his attorney got there, and it had to be stricken.
Now, let me ask you another question.
Sure.
Have you ever fired your weapon in the line of duty?
I have not. I mean, I was a...
Come close, even?
Came close, but not. I was on the road for, I would say, close to 18 years before I went out to the academy and so forth. But we've had our weapons out. We had a call once that there was a vehicle heading east on a thruway.
Mm-hmm.
And gave us the plate number and said... fugitives wanted. There were two fugitives in the vehicle wanted, and we pulled them over and buttoned up our bulletproof vests to make sure they were secure, got out of the car, drew our weapons, pointed the weapons at the car, got on the horn on the loudspeaker and said, out of the car, on the ground. Okay, and these guys got out of the car very peacefully with their hands up, laid down on the pavement on the side of the road. And by that time, there were more trooper cars coming down. And there were three cars down here. And we took them into custody. But we were informed that they were armed and dangerous. And we were ready to do it. But we didn't. And, it despite what you see on TV, I mean,
right.
Shootings are rare. Those kind of things are rare. Maybe not in some cities, but majority and overall, the use of firearms are rare incidents, and they're not like we see on TV all the time.
Now, what police use on the streets has changed a lot since you started, right?
But when I came on, we had the Colt revolver, six-shot revolver.
38 or 357?
38 to start. We went to the 357 after that. Now I guess we're on Glocks, as far as I know. Didn't have computers, didn't have much of the high-tech stuff they have today, cameras and so forth.
Had one light on top of the car?
Yeah, one little red light.
Yeah. Police cars have come a long way since 1965.
They sure have, yeah, definitely. I think it's amazing. Last year I was down at the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference, and walked into their showroom there, and they got license plates readers, and they have identifiers, and they have devices that can disable your car, your computers, and I said, oh my gosh, wow, it's really amazing. We had this little radio, and we had, that was about it, we had a radio, and radar started to evolve a little more during that time, where they invented what they call the moving radar. And the moving radar was a device where you could be going westbound and the other car could be going eastbound, and you'd be able to detect your speed going in a different direction, which was a boon because basically what they did in the 50s and 60s is set up a tripod radar set on the side of the road, and that's the way they did it.
And then have another car a little further down to pick up the car that sped by the radar, right?
Right. And of course, that sort of system on the thruway in Buffalo stopped very abruptly when one of our troopers was killed standing out in the road trying to pull cars over who were detected on radar. And essentially what happened is he stepped out there and a car came through the radar at 90 miles an hour, struck him, and basically cut him in half. And all the troopers at the scene was horrified. And from that point on, there was no more of this this sort of thing where a trooper has to go in the middle of the road and the flag car's down. It's all chase car type operations now.
State troopers see so many horrific things on the highway. And what you just described there, a trooper being literally cut in half by a speeding car and the other troopers having to witness that. How did they cope? How do troopers cope with these things that are commonplace on the highways that are so horrific?
Well, you have to accept, I think, what you're going to see. When you come on the job in the academy, you know, it's all champagne and roses. You're glad to be there. It's a lot. It's strenuous. It's hard, but you know what you don't experience those things in the academy. But when you get out there and you see the dead bodies, you see the abused kids, you see the mutilated homicide victims, it takes a toll on your psyche. And if you're not careful, you can develop post-traumatic stress disorder. You cope best by putting your support together. And to me, I think the best thing I could do when I saw things like that was to come home to my family, and who was very supportive, by the way, and you know, say hello to my kids and so forth. You have to separate yourself. You have to take that plug out, and you have to separate yourself from what you saw there, and you go home to being a quote normal person again. Unfortunately, some officers cannot cope in that way, and because they lose the ability to cope, they develop depression, they develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Sometimes they turn to alcohol, and ultimately, they can die by suicide.
Did you ever have nightmares?
I did. I had nightmares about that accident I told you about with the little baby. That I probably had a nightmare about that for two nights, but that after that it waned. And I've had other nightmares where I lost my gun. I didn't have my gun, and I got. You know, I was getting in a shootout and I didn't have my weapon. I mean, these are all manifestations of fears that one has when they're in this sort of job. But they wane. You know, for most people, post-traumatic stress doesn't last a long time. You'll get the nightmares, you'll get the maybe some flashbacks, but they go away. If they don't go away, then you develop this disorder, this PTSD disorder, and then you need to go help, get some help. But most people handle these things, and most troopers handle these things very well, and most cops in general. They're very...
Because you have to. You have to, or you can't really effectively continue to do the job.
Exactly. I mean, police officers are very resilient people. And, you know, we hear about those who die by suicide. We hear about those that have PTSD. But the majority of officers are resilient, and they are able to deal with this, and they find a good way to cope with it. Those that don't are the ones that suffer.
We're going to take a quick pause so I can tell you that one of the things I love about true crime is that the further you dig into a story, the more layers you uncover. That's part of what I love about the puzzle game Best Fiends, too. Reaching each new level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story. You'll meet characters like Quincy and Temper. You'll go to places like Mount Boom and try to survive Slugmageddon. It's a lot of fun, and you don't need the internet to play the game. You can play it right on your phone. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. I use it while I'm traveling back and forth. So on the train, on the subway, on the bus, you can play it anywhere. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play.
Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Now, before we get back to our conversation, please be aware that the professor's audio will change in the last 5 minutes. Due to some technical difficulties, we finish our conversation over the phone. Now, without further ado, we return with Dr. John Violante. Now, after being a state trooper, your work pivoted to officer mental health. How did that transition come about?
Well, I have a BA in psychology. What I saw in my career was a lot of officers who were hurt by themselves, by their own actions. And what I mean by that is they got involved with alcohol, and they coped in maladaptive ways, you know. Maybe didn't care anymore about the job, got depressed, had trouble with their families, drank a lot, you know, and just basically didn't care, you know, all the signs of depression. And I said, there's something wrong here. You know, why does this job affect people like this? Why does it, what is it? Is the exposure? You know, is it the horrible things you see? Is it is it what it does to your family life? What is it? I need to explore this further. And I was at the Rochester Institute of Technology for a while when I taught undergraduate study in criminal justice. And I started researching and writing at that point PTSD and depression and problems that police officers had. Mm-hmm. And that continued over all these years. I kept researching and researching, and finally I got to a point where, we need to do something about this. We need to establish some programs to help officers get through this stuff, because nobody is helping them. You know, back in the 60s, nobody ever heard of PTSD. Nobody cared. If you didn't like the job, leave. I mean, it was that simple. If you can't handle this, kid, get out of here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that approach, it's a waste of an officer. I mean, we can help people. Mm-hmm. We can rehabilitate people. We can save people very simply. And I thought, this is a good idea. We have to do this. And I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the big hero. I'm going to be the guy who's going to do the research. And I'm going to be the guy that shows the organizations in this country that they need this kind of stuff. So I wrote and wrote and wrote and preached and preached and preached and presented and presented and presented to the best of my ability. And I think, you know, the message is now known, the message has been brought forward, and the movement is going on.
Now, you received your PhD while working on patrol as a state trooper, right?
Yeah. I'd like educate, yes. And my dissertation was on police stress and organizational stress in police officers. When I got through that, I was still on midnight shift, and did a little teaching at UB, assistant teaching and so forth, but continued to work as a trooper until about 85, when I got called to the academy. I was called, I think it was a colonel called me up from Albany, from the State Police Academy. He said, John, you know, we understand that, you know, you've been working and you've been going to school and working on your doctorate and so forth. Would you like to come down here and train some of our recruits in the academy? And I said, oh, yeah, I'd really like to do that. So I ended up going to Albany for a while. While down in Albany, I did some training of recruits. And then after that, I decided that, you know, maybe it's time that the state police set up a program to help troopers who are not feeling well or have depression or perhaps a post-traumatic stress disorder. It was an employee assistance program, basically, and we set it up inside the state police. And there were three of us. There was myself, a lieutenant, and a Catholic brother who happened to be part of the state police because they had known him for so many years. They asked him to come in. Together we started this program, and we basically had to cover the whole state. For example, you know, I was stationed, at that time I was in Albany. If something happened in Buffalo, I had to drive to Buffalo and take care of it there. If something happened in New York City, perhaps the other fellow would take care of that. So that's the way we did it, and we did it for a long time. Today, it's my understanding that that program is still working and in effect and has expanded quite a bit. And now they have three people assigned to each troop. There are basically 10 troops in the state of New York for the state police. And each section or each troop has three people working in it. So it's a big improvement, and you know, I'm very gratified that it's still in existence.
A lot of cops won't talk about their mental health, but they'll talk to maybe their partner, for example, right? They'll talk about something that's traumatized them with their partner if they trust that person that much, but they won't talk to anyone else about it.
That's true. Yeah, that's their biggest problem, getting officers to come forward if they have a mental health problem. You know, there's a stigma in our society about mental health that if you have mental health, you're really not normal. You're crazy. Nothing could be further from the truth. The mental health covers a wide array of different sorts of disorders. PTSD is the best example. It's a disorder, but it's not. It doesn't mean you're crazy. What we need to do, we need to get police officers over that stigma. We need to get police officers out of the influence of the police culture. What the police culture mandates is that you never show weakness. You always be strong. You always be in control. If you show weakness, you're in trouble as a cop. So no one wants to admit that they have a weakness. No one wants to admit that when they saw that dead child, they felt emotion. And because of that, they stuff it inside. And because they stuff it inside, it eats away at them. But I think these can be dealt with on two levels. It can be dealt with on the individual level, and it can be dealt with on the organizational level. You know, changes have to occur in both places. We know that stress is cumulative. We know the more stress you have, the more it accumulates, and the more it affects your body. And we found this in our research here at Buffalo. We find it more and more that there are associations between chronic stress and PTSD and heart disease and diabetes and all of these illnesses that affect us. Stress and illness have a very close relationship. Getting officers to come forward is a problem we're working on. I think peer support programs are good. A peer support program is a program where officers from a department are trained in basic counseling. If an officer has a problem, they can go to a peer support person instead of a mental health professional to get help. This is a good first step because it gets the officer into that peer support who's another officer, which is okay with them, to talk about the incident.
John, what do you wish you had known about mental health when you were a trooper, when you were an officer?
Well, I wish I would have known more about this, about what I know now. Isn't that a famous quotation? If I knew then what I know now. I coped well. I'm not bragging, but I coped well with the job. Again, I had that support system, that mechanism that helped me get through times when I felt bad. And, you know, I never really felt depressed, and I never had symptoms of PTSD. I had a few nightmares, and I had a few afterthoughts about things I'd seen. But I always was able to get back into my normal life. And that was my solace. That was the way I dealt with things. I got back home. If I knew what I know now, I would have been a much stronger advocate of mental health in my early years as a cop. I would have started to talk to administration more about this, that, listen, here's what I know. You should be doing something instead of telling people that if they don't like the job, leave it. Stop punishing people for having problems with stress.
For being human.
Being human, having emotions. We know that stress is inherent in the job. You, organization, you can help alleviate that by establishing a better trust between you and that officer who's in the street. You know, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's out there. I would have been an advocate, and they probably would have yelled at me a lot. But I think it would have been important to bring this forth.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever did.
Absolutely.
You know?
John, you've written several books about the statistics of mental health and police officers. What made you want to publish and pursue this work?
I think certain publications were important for scientists, too. And a lot of my publications are very scientifically based and not really written in lay terms. And the reason I did that is to encourage researchers to develop this whole idea of mental health and police work more, you know, to get more research going, to give an impetus, if you were, to research. And in doing so, enlighten the field and maybe make things better for officers out there.
Well, your work is definitely saving the lives of police officers and helping their families as well. So, Professor John Valianti, thank you so much for being on this show on PD Stories. Thank you for your service as New York State Trooper for 23 years, and may you continue with your work and continue to make life better for law enforcement officers across the country and around the world.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.